Good morning. It's time for Tyler Talks, an informative program that comes your way each weekday morning following the news at 9. We discuss the important issues that affect Tyler County. And now, here's the host of Tyler Talks, Larry Crippen.
How are you doing today? It's the second day of the week. Well, yeah, Monday's all over, and that's good. The 30th day of October, 2007. I'm Larry Crippen along with you, and Tyler Talks here. And the weather? Well, not too bad. I think it's going to be warming up a little bit tomorrow. Right now, it's 53 degrees, mostly sunny today in the forecast. High in the upper 70s by tonight. Partly cloudy, low in the lower 50s, so not quite as cold tonight. Then by tomorrow, Wednesday, mostly sunshine, the high in the lower 80s. We're very glad to have back as our guest again here on Tyler Talks. He was with us, though, months ago, from the Gibb Lewis unit, the chaplain there, and also an author of many books, five or six books, I believe. Mike Maness is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning, Larry. How the heck are you?
Going fine. We've been talking quite a bit before we went on the air here. Had some really stirring conversation here. Very interesting.
Sure did.
Mike and I both do some writing. Mike is a published author, has written several books, and but first we wanted to just touch on a little bit about what he does. Another source of income, probably one of the major sources.
It is my favorite, and my major source of income. You're right. I'm the chaplain out at the Gibb Lewis unit, a 2,200 man maximum and minimum security facility.
Now, tell us a little bit about your job. Can you take us through a typical day, if there is a typical day in your job, and what you do there?
Well, as the staff chaplain, one of the things I take great pride in, and that is also one of the most important functions, is death and critical illness notifications. We're the liaisons between the fellow's families, and when there's a death of an inmate's loved one, we're connecting them on the phone, counseling with them, giving them some comfort, and negotiating with the institution for some time off, and trying to help them cope with that. And obviously, as the chaplain, we facilitate all the religious volunteers for all the religions on the unit. We strongly, and all of TDC, the wardens and the staff, and it's part of TDC policy too, believe in religious freedom. And so we facilitate all the religions of every flavor. As you may know and have heard in the news, we just finished with the Islamic Ramadan, which is their whole month of fasting, and they have a feast day, and we facilitate that and the volunteers that help them with that.
About approximately how many religions do you deal with out there?
There are probably four or five mainline religions, including the Protestant flavors, the Christian faith. We have Father Vecchio from Our Lady of the Pines comes out there regularly, and he has a Catholic deacon that helps him. We obviously have Muslims, our Jehovah's Witnesses, a representative from our local Jehovah's Witness. They've been supremely great volunteers out there. My friend Tim Durr at the Mormon Church here, who runs Durr Collision, is also a great source of books of Mormon for them out there. And then we have some minority faiths like Wiccan, and sometimes a fellow will want to change his faith to Satanism, which we facilitate. We don't try to hold back. There's no need to be threatened by any faith group out there, anything that the guy wants to be. The mainline of religions, you've got to have a volunteer that has expertise in that before we can offer them space, obviously.
And how long have you been doing this? How did you get into this, becoming a chaplain and all this kind of thing?
Through the back door. Like a lot of things in my life, we just worked hard through school and everything. I was a hospital chaplain in San Angelo before I came down here a little over 13 years ago, and have kind of since rooted here in Tyler County and love it.
And you are also an author, is another one of the many things that you do, Mike. And you've written like six books, I believe.
It's about six. It depends on what you call books and everything. But there's five published out now with this latest one.
And the latest one is very interesting. It's called Would You Lie to Save a Life? And we've been talking about the concept of a lying to save a life and truth versus love and that kind of thing before we went on the air here. Many days ago, we were talking about this. Tell me about the book and how you position this philosophy in the book. You refer in this, Would You Lie to Save a Life, to the situation with Commander Booker, who was picked up by the Koreans many years ago. People our age would know about this.
February 1968.
Tell us that story, can you?
Commander Booker was accosted in international waters off North Korea. submarine boats and everything, he had no choice in this little old freighter that was boarded, pirated, sequestered at Wonsan Harbor in North Korea, beaten viciously. Him and the 82 survivors were beaten viciously, and he was forced to lie to save the lives of his men. He had to lie to confess to being in North Korean waters when he was actually in international waters to save the lives of his men. They had first put a gun to his head, and he was willing to die for that cause. But when they pulled out Howard Bland, a young 20-year-old fireman, and threatened to kill him, he signed the confession. That saved the lives of his men. And then for 11 more months, they were held hostage. Their confession itself went into a lot of mutations with numerous hilarities in that confession, including Sol Loxfinger, the Bowery Street billionaires, and absurdities throughout that the North Koreans were not aware of. And the United States negotiated their release in December of 1968. And that is the platform for this entire book, that one scenario.
And you're not suggesting people should go around lying as opposed to the truth. Well, you're defining truth and love in a different kind of way. Would you lie to save a life? It is more of a focused on love, isn't it?
It's valuing both to the nth degree, and our standard is the criterion of Jesus Christ's life and his ability to choose absolutely right choices 100% of the time. And an absolutely right choice is defined as something that is 100% truth and 100% loving. The conflict comes in a circumstance like Bucher's, where most of us would lie to save the lives of our men for something as absurd as water.
Now, you're saying all situations of truth always have a component of love there.
Must have, mm-hmm. as they are at biblical absolutes, especially, that we are under obligation to tell truth and to love equally, and it is sometimes in a fundamentalist category that would sacrifice this issue of love to tell the truth all the time. When really and truly, we are obligated to do both 100% of the time.
Okay, with that, I guess we shouldn't go too deep into this.
It gets very deep.
Philosophical show here.
One of the things that I do in this book is that I contrast three published evangelical systems from three folks that are defending the absolutes of truth and love.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Robert Rakestraw is a professor, was a professor out of Criswell College in Dallas, went to New Bethel in St. Paul. He is the non-conflicting absolutist, and he would actually tell the truth in Bucher's situation even if the men got killed. Mm-hmm. There's Norman Geisler, a very famous ethicist at Dallas Theological Seminary, went on to Lynchburg's Liberty University and then started his own seminary there, I forgot where, and he is the hierarchicalist, which says that you choose the higher choice of love over truth and you're exculpated from the wrong. And then there's Ebby Smith, my former professor of ethics out of Southwestern Seminary, which is the principalist, that chooses a choice similar to Geisler's and that you do the best you can and then it becomes right later. And then I develop another choice where I have trouble understanding what is the absolutely right choice, and I confess I don't know. In Bucher's situation, I don't know what the absolutely right choice is. We do know what the components are. It would be 100% truth and 100% loving. And in that circumstance, as finds a lot of folks, what do? Well, you chose love over truth in this circumstance, but not sacrificing all the truth.
Probably the major argument against this is truth is truth, and that's it. What do you say to that response?
That's true, but we also have obligations to love. And if one of your loved ones was accosted by a murderer who had killed some other folks, and he asked you to say that this white door is a purple polka-dotted door, if I save this person's life, what are you going to do?
Oh, yeah,
well,
right.
The non-conflicting absolutists would say, tell the truth and let God be the judge. But in the insanity of the world, and in Bucher's situation, most of us would lie to save a life and deal with it later. And the primary reason we would do that is because love has just as many obligations as truth does.
Let's move to another book, then. I think we covered this pretty well.
It's
a very complicated
this is my
question,
most,
isn't
my
it?
My most important book.
Yeah,
it grew to 800 pages, went down to 400. There's a lot on the book on the website, preciousheart.net.
If people are interested in this book, that's where they can go, preciousheart.net.
Yeah, you can see all the books on there. Just click on the Would You Lie to Save a Life book, and there's the outline, a full outline of the book on the website, and you can go from there to order it.
And it's called Would You Lie to Save a Life? Love Will Find a Way Home, A Theology on the Ethics of Love. And your middle name is Glenn. I didn't know that, Mike.
It also has endorsements from one of my previous mentors, John P. Newport, the Vice President of Academic Affairs from Southwestern Seminary, and a few other notable professors.
Oh, you think they use some of these in seminaries as a talking point?
They haven't yet because it's just out.
Oh, it's just out.
And my mentor there, one of my mentors, John Newport, passed away a few years ago. This has been 15 years in the making, Larry. I wrote all these other books, two of the other books, in support of this book as auxiliary studies, The Heart of the Living God book, and then the Character Counts book were also auxiliary studies as I was trying to finalize this one.
There are several books like that. I know one notably is Huckleberry Finn. That was a book that Mark Twain, you know, kept putting away for years. That book just sat there, and then it turned out to be his masterpiece, you know. A little bit later on.
This was a very difficult book to write, and I rewrote it over these 15 years at least a dozen times. It ballooned to over 800 pages, and then I was able to finally whittle it down, having had several readers to go through it, and I'm very glad to finally get it off the shelf.
And let's talk about another one of your books. There's another book. You talk a lot about ethics, the ethical questions, and one of your books was called Character Counts. Let's talk about that. Tell me about it.
Well, that started as an auxiliary book to this one. Mm-hmm. I was wanting to study character and its influence on ethics. And I am a Mason, a Freemason, and after I had become a Mason, I decided to really study Freemasonry because I didn't like what the Southern Baptist Convention had to say about this. So I contacted the major players in this, including Paige Patterson at Southwestern in Fort Worth and the author of the little ditto against Freemasonry from the Southern Baptist website, and I studied it in depth and had intended to write a critique of that. And then, as one thing... came to another, it grew into a very large work in itself. It's over 700 pages, actually two books in one, and I decided at the beginning to not hold back because of some of the things that have been said about Freemasons in the past. Some of the things have just been terrible.
What are some of your points in Character Counts?
Well, in the first one, I give the anti-Mason Frankenstein the beating of his undead life, and I plow up the graveyard, and really have a good time at it, because some of the things that have been terrible. One of the things that James Hawley says is that Masons are satanically inspired. Well, it doesn't get any worse than that. The major point throughout the whole book, and this is the fulcrum, and this is what is most important in all of the literature for the last 300 years, the most important thing, is that character counting is the sledgehammer that drives the wedge of credibility between the anti-Masons and Freemasonry credibility. And I quote this, character counting, it is the person. When you go talking to the best Freemasons that you know, you mention that your father was a Mason or your grandfather?
Well, yeah, actually he was, my grandfather.
What kind of a man was he?
They're both good men, yeah.
What's it going to take to convince you that those folks are devil-inspired folks? That's where some of these anti-Masons have gone off of the edge, way off into the edge in allegations that make no sense, and the issue of credibility hinges on character counting. And when you look at the public statements of Freemasonry and what Freemasonry is about, it is all about character counting.
What are some of the other books? You want to talk about anything else you've written?
I've got one coming up.
Another one.
Hopefully, yeah, at the beginning of this next year is Ocean Devotions. And I culled through 30 years of sermons from Charles S. Spurgeon pulled out 365 unique metaphors on the ocean and sailing. So each devotion for each day of the year will have a unique devotion from some aspect of sailing, the ocean, the waves, the fighting the elements and so forth, and that was a very blessed experience to go through those.
Do you sail by any chance?
No, I
I thought maybe that's...
I've just had an affinity to that. I like to think one of my friends is going to be the president of our Lions Club here, up here, the Captain Millard Scott. And he was a ship captain there. He knows how to parallel park supertankers and did that as a pilot in the Gulf down there, and several other friends over the years, but that's partly what inspired that, is just my friends with some of the mariners over the time. Ocean Devotions from the hold of Charles H. Spurgeon, the master of mariner metaphors.
And I know I've heard quite a bit about it. I'm not a theologian, but Spurgeon is
He's considered the prince of preachers, and you can just go just about anywhere and pick up CDs, and thank God for the computer. That's how I was able to search out and find all of these different metaphors that he's used over 30 years.
Why were you drawn to him, to pick him as somebody to write about his works?
I have found some of his sermons to be the most inspiring things on the planet. He is the master of metaphor. And even though I found 365 unique metaphors on the ocean, every one of his sermons is packed, filled with metaphor, and that's why he was able to communicate so well. And it's one of the ways Jesus was able to communicate, as he said that I didn't teach, but out of a parable, in a way. And we find his most memorable words having the point driving home with a metaphor. And that's what made Charles Spurgeon so very famous and so attractive in everything that he did, is that he was able to capture in a metaphor and in a story and in an analogy some beautiful, powerful, deep spiritual truth.
And when did you start writing, actually? How old were you? What drove you to start writing?
Forever. While I was in seminary, God granted me a great, great answer to prayer. I worked very hard. It took me 10 years to get my bachelor's degree. When I finally landed in Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth for 5 years, he gave me a security guard job where I was able to study 6-7 hours a night. One of my favorite reads was a New York Times book review that I got each week, and I would sit down at the end of the week and read that, and I got to thinking, hey, I can write some of the stuff that's being published these days. The first book was Fringes of Freedom, which has been out since it was right after 9/11. I decided I would go ahead and try to push this to getting published, but it took place in 1968.
Very interesting. Anything else to add, Mike?
Hey, Larry, it's just great to talk with you and share with you, and appreciate you giving me this time.
You're quite welcome. And again, what's the name of the website where people can look over your
www.preciousheart.net, and you can see all the books on there. And God bless you.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. We've been talking with Mike Mavis, chaplain at the Gift Lewis Unit, also author right here on Tyler Talks. Please join us again tomorrow right here at 9 for Tyler Talks.
This has been Tyler Talks with Larry Crippen. Be listening each weekday morning following the news at 9 for Tyler Talks from AM 1490 KWUD Radio, keeping Tyler County informed.